Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? You get what you need.
Oh. And you know, that is the question that so many people ask themselves, and they believe that they really do want to change. And then that compulsive, addictive behavior continues. And it seems like for so many people, unless they have a strong support system, they are not able to bypass the compulsion to act out, to seek prostitution, to seek multiple affairs, to seek pornography, to expose themselves, to do voyeurism. And, you know, you've heard me say it before, you need a strong, strong social support system and a good recovery plan. Well, hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets. I'm Carol the Coach, and I am here every Monday night to help you with this issue. And, you know, I got to tell you, I'm going to just be honest. I got off of a vacation last week. I was gone for 10 days. I couldn't get out the show. I was in the Caribbean, and it just wouldn't work. The Internet wouldn't access it. My phone wouldn't access it. It was like it was not meant to be. And I felt so bad about that, and then I got back that Monday before the next show, and I did my show and had a great time. Actually, I interviewed Dr. John Caldwell, who talked about mindfulness, and one of the beautiful things about this show is that not only do you learn from it, but I do too. I always say it's my 1 hour of talk to the experts and find out what's going on in the field. It keeps me fresh. It keeps me excited, invigorated, and it gives me extra tools just as it gives you. That's the good news. And it better be the good news because, you know, I pay to have this show. You know, I do this for you all because I know that this is something that at this point in our lives, there's not enough information about it. And media really can help somebody to get the information. And unfortunately, there isn't enough going on. So I feel honored. And I feel excited to be able to disseminate this information, get it to you, learn myself. But this is a long-winded story to say that sometimes I say, you know, Carol, you work on Mondays. You work 11 hours. I end with my sexual addiction group for men. And it's an incredibly long day. I actually get up at 5 a.m. so I can do my outer circle behavior so that I can do my reading, do my inspiration, do my prayer, do my meditation, and do my exercise, at which point I listen to podcasts. I don't listen to my own typically, but I do listen to Cheryl Richardson, Wayne Dyer, Tony Robbins, Patrick Carnes, And on occasion, if I'm doing a special presentation, I will go back to one of my podcasts and listen to it just to remind myself of what some of the experts are saying. I really believe in that. It's important to me. So anyway, but sometimes I think, should I just give this up? Should I quit? Well, you know, is it worth the time? I'm exhausted by the time 9 o'clock rolls around on a Monday night. That's Eastern Standard Time. And you all know the show starts for us Easterners, well, Midwesterners too, at 9 o'clock and runs till 10. Well, while I was on vacation, I got a letter from Carrie. And Carrie said, "Hi, Carol. First of all, I just want to thank you for all the work you do to educate the people on sexual addiction. I just recently discovered that my significant other, we live together, has a sexual addiction. Your podcasts have helped me tremendously to learn more about this disease." Now, the reason she said that, for any of you that listen through Blog Talk, is that you can download all of my podcasts on iTunes. You just either put in Carol the Coach, or you put in Sex Help with Carol the Coach, or you put in sexual addiction, and I'm the only therapist that comes up doing this kind of show. And I'm assuming that that's probably what she did. So she goes on to say, "I do feel that sexual addiction is a disease. I'm excited to say that my partner's first therapy meeting is next week, and I'm anxious to see how that goes. He seems to truly want to get help and change." Now, that's what I am promising you. I am promising that if you are somebody who really wants to change, you can make your relationships different. You can make your own life different. But you can't do it, and I'm gonna swear here, you can't do it half-assed. You've got to be all in, not halfway in, halfway out. And by that I mean you have to employ a variety of resources, not just go to a meeting here or there, or even one or two meetings a week. You may, if you're new, need 3, 4, or 5 meetings a week. By meetings, I'm referencing 12-step meetings, Essanon, SAA, COSA, Recovering Couples. You know, there's just a variety of meetings out there centering around sexual addiction. So this woman's significant other is heading for therapy for the very first time. And I pray and I hope that his therapist is a certified sexual addictions therapist. Why? Because they have the specialized skills and training to get right in there, figure out what some of the issues are, and make the proper recommendations. I would love to tell you that all my clients get help. That they, you know, once they meet with me, their lives turn into gold and they no longer have to struggle with the disease. But that just isn't true. But what I can assure them and what I believe about myself is that they're getting way more help from me than the average therapist because I am trained in this disorder. I do know the resources available. So anyway, if you want to know about a CSAT, a Certified Sexual Addiction Therapist, in your city, town, state, go to www.sexhelp.com, put in your zip code, and see what comes out. They're all specially trained and designated to provide this work. And now, and I'll have to get this information from you. I forget what it is. I'm a member of this organization, but it's SASH. The sexual advancement of, you know, good sexual health. And they now have started a training program too, and I'm sure it's going to be excellent, absolutely excellent. So anyway, this woman, Carrie, says, "The discovery that I made about my partner was by chance. I picked up his phone one night and was going through it, and I still didn't know what made me go through it. I had no idea or suspicions of any kind. He didn't act strange. He wasn't withdrawn. He wasn't hiding his phone. However, over the course of the last month, I have discovered he has been reaching out to escorts for over a year and admits to meeting two of them for sex. Okay, now, Carrie says she absolutely had no conscious understanding or indication that her significant other was cheating. But see, we have three parts of the brain. The conscious part that makes us reach for our pen so that we can write. The subconscious part that hints or tugs at us to do something, to feel something, to believe something, but we go in and out of it, almost like a mouse on a screen. You know, consciously, I may want to lose weight, but subconsciously, I may sabotage the bejeebies out of that and eat that piece of cake that I really don't want, not if I want to lose weight. And then that third part of the brain is the unconscious, and that's the part that, well, for many people, they may have experienced a trauma or something in their childhood that continues to catapult them towards unhealthy behaviors. So here's this guy who appears happily together with his girlfriend, Carrie, and yet he's gone to escorts over the past year and certainly reaching out. Now, if he's been doing that for a year, Carrie, I got to tell you, he's probably been with more than two. However, what difference does the number matter? It doesn't matter. It's the behavior. So she says, you know, I'm having a problem with trying to move forward and not be so angry. I will have a good day where I feel things are going to be okay, and then I let myself go to a dark place where just the sight of him makes me sick. How do I work towards forgiveness? He has been completely transparent and seems to want to get help, and I do love him. He has a very good heart, and I feel like his porn addiction just escalated to physical meetings with escorts. While I am thankful it was physical and not him forming an emotional attachment, I still can't seem to get past that deep hurt. Well, she says, you know that hurt that makes you feel like you were kicked in the stomach. And then she says, LOL. Well, guess what? I don't think it's funny. I get that you feel kicked in the stomach. I get that you're incredibly hurt. I get that it's hard for you to trust that the hurt goes deep and that you consciously believe, you absolutely consciously believe that it was only two meetings and it was only, it was just starting. But I bet you that subconscious or unconscious part says, wow, you know what, this goes deeper because we had a good relationship, and for him to do this tells me that he's got a lot of work to do on himself. She says, well, Carol, I just needed to vent a little, I guess. I've downloaded your podcast, and they are very helpful. Truly thank you for all that you do for SA and their partners. Just wanted you to know that you're reaching people and you make a difference in other people's worlds. Well, I love that. I'm so glad that I'm making a difference. It re-edifies why I drink a cup of coffee on Monday nights. Yes, I do. To get going again so that I will have the energy to reach out to other people, to interview guests, to do my reading, to write my questions out, and to stay as current as I possibly can in this young field where we are all pioneers. So, Carrie, thank you very much for your letter. You inspire me. I'm very happy, happy to be doing this. For you, the partner, and obviously for my addicts. You know, I can't tell you enough how much I care about my addicts. They are all working so hard, no matter what level they're in. And if they're not working hard, I know that's a part of the addiction. And it's up to me to get them to the point where they at least break through the denial so they see that in themselves. Now, tonight, I'm going to be interviewing a woman by the name of Heather Lowry. She's a licensed professional counselor. She's a chemical dependency counselor, and she's in private practice in Dallas, Texas. She specializes in intimacy disorders, including love and sex addiction. And she really has done a lot of work around eating disorders and body image. And she does see a correlation between people that have eating disorders and love and sex addiction. She's going to be talking to us about the work that she's done. Heather counsels men and women struggling with sex and love addiction, working with both addicts and their partners. She has a passion for working with young adults, and she really feels compelled to help people struggling with eating disorders. So we're going to find out the correlation between eating disorders and sex addiction, and why people are love addicts and sex addicts, and how is this an intimacy disorder, and I'm real excited to be interviewing her tonight. She has a lot to offer, and when she responded to one of the listservs that I'm on, I thought, this is a woman that I want to have on the show. So get your pencils out and write down that her website is letstalkdfw.com. Website is www.letstalkdfw.com. And again, her name is Heather Lowry. So I welcome her to the show, as she's got a lot of information to offer. Heather, welcome to our show, Sex Help with Carol the Coach.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, you have committed yourself to working with love addiction, sex addiction, eating disorder, and other chemical dependency issues. And yet you started out as an accountant. And that still plays an important role in your life. So describe a little bit about your start as a professional and how all these things are interwoven together.
Sure. Okay, well, yeah, I started off as an accountant. I was an accountant in corporate America for about 7 years and was not a fan at all. But counseling and psychology was always my first love, and finally just took the plunge when I was 27 and decided to go back to get my master's in counseling to pursue that. I think that it's so important for people to realize that, you know, money isn't everything. And I know I was under the misguided belief that, you know, if I made enough money, you know, as an accountant, then it wouldn't matter that I didn't necessarily enjoy what I was doing. And it feels amazing being on the other side of that, being in a job and a career that I love. And so honestly, I feel like that's a big part of what addictions, how addictions can develop. It's using a substance or a person or a behavior to kind of numb your pain.
Well, even money, because money is very numbing, and a lot of people, I kind of cringe when women will say, oh, well, when I'm really feeling bad, I go into retail therapy, which, of course, means they spend
right.
their little hearts out.
Right. And that has the consequences of that, you know, they can go along with the same as sex addiction and eating disorders, honestly, because it feels good in the moment, and then you have to deal with the consequences of it afterwards.
Absolutely. So what made you flip into this world of addictions?
Yeah, I really didn't know. I always had an interest in eating disorders ever since I knew I was going to be switching careers. But it wasn't until I was in a marriage and family class and I did a presentation on sex addiction and started reading Patrick Carnes' work. And I really was able to see the correlation between eating disorder, body image, and the obsessive dieting, and it was just really fascinating to me how they really played along with each other. People, you know, going on a crash diet because they've started a new relationship. The more I learned about one, the more it piqued my interest of the other, and so I've kind of just kept going on with that, and I'm really fascinated by the correlation.
Well, so explain, what is that correlation in the mind of a man or a woman who's in a relationship and they start really curtailing what they take into their body?
Sure. So when I talk about sex addiction, I really like to preface it by using the three terms as far as a relationship, romance, or sex addiction. because what I've found in working with clients that because of the lack of education on what sex addiction really is, people have their own opinion of it. So they're real quick to say, well, I don't do that, so therefore what I'm doing isn't a problem. But when you look at relationship and romance addiction, it's a lot more difficult to deny some of their behaviors. And so it plays, the correlation is, again, it's really fascinating. There's a book called Women, Sex, and Addiction by Charlotte Castle, and it's one of the first books that I saw that really side-by-side compared what these the similarities between eating disorders and sex addiction. The fact is that they both can be misused. They can be used as a source of pleasure as well as for fulfillment. They can be used obsessively. They can be used as bribery. They can be used to act out anger towards one another. I'm sure we've all had times where, you know, you're having a bad day and so there's a plate of cookies in the break room at work and, you know, people scarfing down a plate of cookies. You know, whether or not we want to do it affects our experience of sex as well as with food. Sometimes, you know, people might force a meal on us, and that can feel very intrusive if somebody is forcing you to eat something that you don't want. They can both leave you feeling shameful and empty, lonely and sad, or leave you feeling content, filled up, and happy. So, and again, the list keeps going on and on.
Well, you know, clearly you're right. Feelings absolutely affect people's reactions and their need to either numb themselves or express themselves. Tell me a little bit about your work with people that have eating disorders. What actually do you employ to get them to think more healthily and to create behaviors that support that?
Well, one of the biggest things is actually helping people realize that some of their behaviors are dangerous. Dieting and eating disorder behaviors a lot of times runs in families, and so people have been practicing these behaviors as long as they can remember. They might have had a mom or a sister or all their girlfriends were doing the same thing to the point where they don't even realize that what they're doing is considered disordered. And so one of the biggest things is helping them realize, you know, what are some of the consequences that are coming from your behavior? By the time they're coming to treatment, it's usually because there's been a quantifiable consequence that they've had to deal with, be it health concerns. That's usually the biggest thing when people realize it, when the health consequences of eating disorders. But also it could be a parent or a significant other really bringing to their attention that, you know, they don't look well. So it's getting them in there and figuring out why the use of an eating disorder has been their choice of coping, their coping mechanism choice.
And can you briefly explain the different types of eating disorders?
Sure. So the three most, I don't want to say most common, but maybe the most recognizable as far as names, are anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. Anorexia is what you might typically see as the person who looks emaciated, and so that's basically the restriction of calories relative to one's health requirements. There's an intense fear of gaining weight and a severe disturbance in perception, so they're seeing something that is not necessarily there. And actually, contrary to belief, some anorexics can also, they may use binging and purging behaviors. Bulimia is what more people think of as a person who will binge on a great meal and then use compensatory behaviors is a nice way to put it. So it might be through vomiting or use of laxatives, overexercise, diuretics. It goes the number of behaviors. And there's, again, they have that same disturbance in body, in perception of how they look. Binge eating is similar to bulimia, but without the compensatory behaviors. So it's just recurrent periods of consuming large amounts of food and a feeling of powerlessness while they're binging. A third one that it's not necessarily, it's classified as an eating disorder, but doesn't always involve food. It's called body dysmorphic disorder. And that's when one has a preoccupation with one or more flaws or perceived defects in their appearance. So they may think that there's something wrong with their nose, and so maybe we'll fixate on, you know, getting plastic surgery to fix their nose and get 5 or 6 surgeries, and because of this perceived defect that they see. And so this may or may not relate to weight or body fat. So that's why it's classified as an eating disorder, but, you know, again, somebody's nose doesn't necessarily correlate to their feelings with food, but it's just an overall preoccupation with a perceived personal defect.
Okay, so I got a question, because obviously you said with sexual anorexia, people will mm-hmm. actually see things that aren't there. They'll see themselves as larger, correct?
Yes.
And then
yes,
with
actually,
body,
with all of them.
Oh, with all of them. I was going to say, because with body dysmorphia, it's almost like they over-exaggerate, again, what may or may not be there. And
right.
all of these things translate into the brain that they're not good enough, they don't look good enough, and maybe even that they're repulsive on some level.
Right.
Okay.
And so, if that's an underlying belief, then the way to get that validation is externally. If you don't feel that way on the inside, well, I'm going to get somebody else to make me feel that way.
Okay, give me an example, a real life example.
Sure. Okay, there can be somebody who is a sex addict, a female sex addict, who realizes that she gets more attention when she looks a certain way, when she's a certain weight. So that might be a weight that is somewhat difficult for her to maintain, but because she can get her her sexual fix when she looks that way, she might develop eating disorder behaviors, because she realizes if I weigh X amount of pounds, that's when I get the most male attention and I'm able to act out sexually. And so as a way to maintain that weight, she might pick up eating disorder behaviors, and then that in itself becomes a problem.
Got it. And so she picks, because of her eating disorder, because of how she views herself, she begins to compulsively act out sexually, and pretty soon that, too, becomes such a habit that it becomes a behavior that she can no longer control.
Exactly. But it goes both ways. Somebody can start off as primarily with an eating disorder, and for whatever reason, some sex addiction behaviors are what they choose to compensate with, to the point where it becomes unmanageable.
Okay, and so here you are. You said that you started out being interested in this field because of Patrick Carnes and some of the information that he had actually written about.
Yes.
And how did you then get these types of clients to find out that indeed there was this correlation between one of the three types of eating disorders and sexual addiction?
Well, it's funny. I didn't even have to seek it out. It presented in eating disorder patients as opposed to trying to find sexual addiction clients who happen to have eating disorder, and it actually worked the other way. There were eating disorder clients who I felt like were stalling in some of their progress because we were managing the eating disorder symptoms and their meals and some of those distorted beliefs, but not really examining their relationship patterns. And so in speaking with them more about, you know, what were family relationships like with you? How is your dating life? What are their typical patterns in your relationships? Once you start seeing some of those patterns, it made a lot of sense that even though some of the eating disorder behaviors might be under control, there's an underlying relationship or romance addiction that is still fueling it. And so until that gets under control, the eating disorder won't ever fully be managed.
So describe it from your terminology, what is a romance disorder? And how is
sure.
that different from a love addiction?
Okay, right. So I classify, like I said, I separate romance, relationship, and sex addiction between the three. I find that it helps people, it keeps people more, better saying, from making excuses as far as, well, I don't do that, so I'm not a sex addict. So when I look at a romance addiction, I'm looking at the person who is addicted to the fairy tale, the idea of what romance is for them. And that can, you know, sometimes not even involve another person. It's just so much based in fantasy.
Okay.
And so they may pursue, they'll maybe pursue people who are already in relationships. Again, another person doesn't even need to be involved. There's no concept of the people who may be hurt while they're pursuing this. So if there's a family or a marriage that's in play, or if they're married or have a family to consider, just the idea of romance is they're high. And so when I look at a relationship addiction, I look at that as when somebody is more likely they're addicted to a specific relationship, like a specific person, or the overall concept of a relationship. So the belief that them as a person is not enough. They have to be part of a couple.
Okay, so now, obviously, you just did a really nice job of describing that. From a brain chemistry standpoint, can you tell me what happens in the brain when someone has that addiction to relationship or romance?
Right. It's going to be the same as it is with drugs, with food, and with sex. It's that same high, and I think that that is where people get confused and will think that certain things, I don't understand how that's an addiction, but it's understanding that it hits the brain in the same way. It's people just have a different drug of choice. And so for somebody with a romance addiction, the pursuit of the romance is what's going to give them a high. A relationship addiction, it might be the specific person or being a couple or getting engaged. Those are the things that give them the high. The partner is secondary. It's more of this image that they have in their mind of what it means to be in a relationship or being part of the fairy tale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because I know that certainly for people with drug or alcohol addictions, they're getting a hit of both dopamine and OxyContin and all sorts of serotonin stabilizers. And you're saying actually with love addiction and romance addiction, it's the same thing.
Yes, it's just a different thing that's providing that high.
Okay. So now, are there certain populations that are more susceptible to eating disorders?
Not populations necessarily. For a long time, there was a belief that eating disorders were related to were related to race, so sometimes considered like a rich white woman's disease. And so luckily that stigma is dying out. I think, in my opinion, it might have presented in a certain population first, but more so because that population actually had the means to get treated for it. So the fact is the higher socioeconomic status, regardless of race or ethnicity, the link to eating disorder increases, which I thought was interesting. There have been a number of studies showing how once Americanized television was brought to certain countries, their eating disorder, the likelihood of eating disorders increased just once they were exposed to Americanized television.
And why do you think that is?
As far as with the media, I mean, that's its own separate talk, the role of the media in eating disorders. It's the fact that there are idealized images that are put out there as the norm, and that teaches people that they're not good enough. You know, as simple as that. It's the beautiful people who are successful, who are in love, who can go on amazing vacations and have the perfect family. And so, if you don't look a certain way, then therefore you're not worthy of having those things.
Okay. Got it. Well, you know, when I was growing up and going to undergraduate and graduate school, my experience was that eating disorders occurred in late adolescence and early, college-age kids. But it really mm-hmm. does affect people across the board. There is no one age that is more prone to an eating disorder, correct?
No, there really isn't. There are children in grade school that can have it, as well as women in their 60s and 70s and inpatients. These disorders last a lifetime if they're not treated. Like I said before, many times they're passed down from generation to generation, and so mm-hmm. A mother might not realize that she has a problem until she sees how it's affected her daughters.
Got it.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so granted, this is not going to affect young kids, but eating disorders and sex addiction may seem like a stretch for some people. Can you give me some examples from your clients that show this kind of connection?
Sure. So another example that always jumps out to me is sometimes I'll do the comparison of some of the sex addiction behaviors that we've learned about, the 10 types of sex addiction, and uh-huh. realizing that there's very similar ways that they manifest with eating disorders. For instance, the exhibitionist sex that we talk about in those 10 types. With eating disorders, there are websites that are pro-eating disorder websites that show people how to have a good eating disorder. You know, and so I compare that to people who are people with sex addiction who are exhibitionists, you know, showing themselves in the same way the person with an eating disorder might take a picture of themselves, you know, because they can see their ribs and they're so proud of the fact that they can see their ribs. With the pain exchange, eating disorders, people might not realize it, but eating disorders can be very, very violent. What it does to your body is painful and can cause pretty severe damage. And so along with the pain exchange sex, with eating disorders, you know, somebody might specifically use a more painful form of their eating disorder as a way of punishing themselves, specifically bulimia. Bulimia can be very violent. And so that plays out. And one way that they will interact, the way that I found the most is when somebody sexually acts out and then after the high of that comes down and the shame, they will restrict their food or binge and purge as a way to punish themselves for sexually acting out.
Okay, so in a lot of respects, you're talking about not violence as in person against person, but engaging in behaviors that are harmful and violent. And how is purging violent?
Okay, so I mentioned earlier that with purging, they can vomit or use laxatives, diuretics, overexercise. So, for instance, I'm sure anybody who's been sick, I mean, when you're vomiting, it does not feel good. It hurts, and that's when you're actually sick. Well, with bulimia, they're trying to throw up when their body does not want them to. So that is it's hard on the heart, in the throat, the very bad on the teeth, blood vessels in the eyes. With laxatives, you know, we're not talking about a normal dosage of laxatives, so that's very hard on the digestive system and the bowel, the intestines, and the fact that it's just painful. And so sometimes, again, like with sex addiction, the more painful something is, that is actually the feeling that the person is going for. There's some sort of connection between the sensation of pain and the high.
Got it. And, you know, I've often heard that pain and pleasure are very close together so that in some ways, although it can be very painful for somebody to engage in a behavior, there's also that chance that that does bring some pain, if nothing else in that sense of control, like I can do whatever I need to affect the change that I want.
Right, and if they've had a history of abuse, this might be the one time where they get to be in control of their own pain.
Somebody else was
always the one hurting them. Well, now they are the ones in control of that.
Okay, so besides exhibitionism, how might eating disorders manifest in those with sexual addictions?
Okay. So I mentioned, like I said, the biggest one is the sexually acting out and then restricting or binging and purging as a result of shame and being angry at themselves and maybe sexually acting out. Also,
Let's talk about that for 1 second, because you're using the word purging, and purging in your world means what?
I'm sorry, purging is any compensatory behavior after a binge, so vomiting or laxative, diuretic, over-exercise, those are what we consider purging, anything that you're using to expend calories or food.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's any of those behaviors that extremely limit or, you know, obviously interfere with normal processes in the body.
Right, yes, the normal absorption and digestion of food.
Okay, so the correlation between eating disorders and sexual addictions may be the binging and purging that naturally occurs in both conditions. And it's interesting
yes.
for our listening audience, what we know to be true is that if somebody is participating in a sexual addiction, male or female, and they are binging, they are just out of control, they're seeking lots of escorts, lots of prostitutes, lots of infidelity, lots of pornography, lots of exhibitionism, whatever it is, they will also go through periods of anorexia, which means they stop everything. And it's almost like it's their drastic way of telling themselves that they have their behavior under control. But what we know is extremes never work, and so that then propels or catapults them into that binging again.
Right, and also because of the disorders that have such a high comorbidity, such as with drug substance abuse and other financial disorders, people mm-hmm. may appear to be in recovery from one thing when really they've just picked up another addiction to compensate for it. So, for instance, somebody in recovery for sexual addiction, they may seem like their behaviors are under control, but if you were to look over time, they may have, you know, gained 50 pounds in 2 months or lost 50 pounds in 2 months or increased their debt. So it can be really confusing because on one side it looks like the person maybe is in recovery for the addiction, and then you realize that they have compensated with another behavioral addiction.
Uh-huh. Good point. And I always talk to my listening audience about the fact that whenever somebody has curbed an addictive behavior, but especially sexual addiction, since that's what this show is about, if they aren't utilizing all their resources and going to 12-step meetings and have a sponsor and doing their recovery reading and praying and meditating and having a fellowship and talking to other people, it's more than likely another behavior will become addictive, whether that be spending, gambling, eating, drinking, drugging, working. I mean, there's always something that seems to get exacerbated when one behavior is curtailed.
Right, definitely.
Yeah, which puts them at real risk. I mean, that's why you've got to be able to use all your recovery tools. So when you're working with these kind of folks, what do you advocate in terms of a recovery program?
Well, a big part of it is maintaining sexual boundaries and being aware of whatever their situation is. I tend to work with 20-somethings, and so a lot of them are single, And so one big challenge, a challenge is that because they're still in the dating age, they're wanting to go out and meet people, which is completely normal. But, you know, being able to manage, okay, what are, if I'm a love addict or if I'm a romance addict and I have eating disorder tendencies, how is that going to look when I'm picking a partner? And so they have a unique challenge versus somebody who's struggling with that who maybe is already in a relationship or already married, because these are people who are constantly out there in the on the battlefield, if you will. You know, the, one of the most dangerous places for eating disorders and love and sex addicts is going to be the dating and the bar scene.
So absolutely. Do you see a difference between men and women and eating disorders and or sexual addiction?
Yeah, there are differences. Both of them can have the main ones, the with anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, and body dysmorphic. They all, both men and women, can have those. What I found different in men is that one thing that men tend to have is with body dysmorphic, ironically, more based on feeling like they should have more muscles, fixated on abs, on arms and on legs and back. And so an eating disorder may develop because they're focused on maintaining this body ideal, which may or may not be linked to a sex or a love addiction, but their eating disorder being very much focused on an over-exercise and sometimes moving over to use of steroids to maintain this certain physique.
I am talking with Heather Lowry, and she is a licensed professional counselor and chemical dependency specialist in private practice in Dallas, Texas. She's talking tonight about eating disorders and sexual addiction and helping us to understand the dynamics in both of those disorders and how oftentimes they can fuse together. Her website is www.letstalkdfw.com, and you can reach her at heatherlpc@letstalkdfw.com. So now tell me, what's the DFW stand for?
Oh, in Dallas, it's for Dallas-Fort Worth. Fort Worth is another big city that's about 30 miles away, and so I use that too. We here in Dallas, we tend to just connect them as DFW, and so I use that to not be exclusionary, because I think that what I'm doing is a specialty, and there's not very many people who are really focusing on those two things. So I wanted just everyone in the Dallas-Fort Worth area to realize that this is, you might have to make a little bit of a drive, but you know, it's that sobriety and that peace from sex addiction, eating disorders is worth it. So it was just the way to be all inclusive for the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Well, that is the perfect segue into one of my very last questions. I want to know, where can people struggling with both eating disorders and sex addiction seek treatment?
Sure. Surprisingly, you know, when you look at treatment centers with eating disorder treatment as well as with sex addiction treatment, most places will have a substance abuse pass.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so surprising to me that there are very few that have a sex addiction has an eating disorder pass or vice versa. But luckily, I think because most people recognize eating disorders as a family disease, there is work being done to include healthy relationships and understanding relationship dynamics with eating disorders. There are a number of great inpatient, depending on the area. The Renfrew Center is the oldest one. It's probably 30 years old now, and it's primarily on the East Coast, but they have them all across the country. There's one specifically that I know of in Tennessee that actually does have a sex and love addiction and eating disorder track. It's called The Ranch. And I'm not affiliated with any of these, but I just have been seeking out specific ones that will focus on both.
Absolutely. And The Ranch is in Nashville, Tennessee, is it not?
Yes. It's maybe an hour outside of Nashville. And so that they have specifically a track, which is amazing. I'm actually going to be able to go out and visit it at the end of the month. And I just think it's huge. I to focus on one without addressing the other, I think really does the client a disservice. And it can allow them to stay in the addiction because, again, with eating disorder treatment, they can look like they're doing everything right, and then you realize, oh, by the way, they go out on the weekends and they're having anonymous sex. So they're managing their eating disorder symptoms by ramping up, you know, a sex addiction behavior. So that's really important. And if people are wanting more information on eating disorders in general, the National Eating Disorders Association, NEDA, has wonderful information. And I have links to all of those on my website. And I'm happy to, if anyone has any questions, they can send me an email and I'll help them the best I can.
Okay, so one more time, remind them of your email address.
My email is Heather, LPC, for Licensed Professional Counselor, at letstalkdfw.com. And my website is www.letstalkdfw.com.
Yes, I mean, even that website seems so friendly and so easy to access. And I mean, you definitely take the shame out of addiction. That is so not only professional but compassionate of you. Because let's face it, there is a lot of shame attached to any type of addictive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, and,
so
and especially,
we
begin, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and especially with sex and love addiction. And so by being able to bring those out of the darkness, I think that it will help so many men and women confront both of these issues.
Oh, 100%. Now, as we begin to wrap up, tell me if there was one thing you could tell people that are listening to the show that know they struggle with both one form of an eating disorder, if not two, as well as sexual addiction. What would you say to them?
I would say to be honest with themselves, to be honest with why they're using one behavior or the other, and what they're trying to cope with. I mean, eating food and sex are the things that we always have control over from a very, very young age. We have access to drugs later and drinking and pornography, but feeling good using sex and using food, that's something that's all ours. And so there's a reason that people will hold on to that, and I call all of these things intimacy avoidant behaviors. So
mm-hmm.
taking a look at what they're so afraid of, and what the eating disorder and what sex addiction is keeping them from. Because if you don't know what it's keeping you from, you might not have the hope to try to fight it, because it seems like there's nothing else on the other side.
And what are some common themes or issues that typically keep people in the dark? You know, you said
in the dark.
Avoiding. Yeah.
Right, a need for control. Eating disorders are not about food in the same way we know sex addiction isn't about sex, or love addiction isn't about love. Control is a big part of what keeps eating disorders, keeps the hold that they have. And so that can stem from, family of origin, and people who have a trauma background may feel a need to control their environment so rigidly. And so it's recognizing, are you in an unsafe situation? Sometimes we feel like we need to be in control because we're not safe. So are you in an unsafe situation now, or, was the child version of you in an unsafe situation, and so this was a coping mechanism you developed for a different time? Sometimes we outgrow coping mechanisms. So, being aware of what it is they're protecting themselves from, and why they feel the need to be in so much control.
Okay. And as we end for today, is there anything else that you would like to share with our listening audiences? You've done a great job of explaining that correlation between eating disorders and sex.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, what I would really just, I would encourage people to email me or go to my website if they have more questions about it, or if they, you know, if they have a specific question, to email me, because for so many people, they don't recognize how one behavior might influence another. I'm sure we've all heard, you know, if somebody's going through a breakup, you know, a bunch of girlfriends say, oh, come over and we'll eat, you know, a tub of ice cream and talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's something to be said about maybe eating a little too much when you're upset. That doesn't mean you have an eating disorder. But I think we all know when it goes a little bit too far, when someone realizes it's not just a tub, it's two tubs of ice cream, and it's when I'm by myself, and it's multiple times a week. So if anyone has any personal questions or wondering if they, you know, if maybe they need to speak with somebody who specifically works with eating disorders, mm-hmm. I would be, you know, I'd be happy to take those emails and, you know, point them in the right direction.
Well, and go ahead one more time and tell us your website.
Sure. It's www.letstalkdfw.com.
Okay. Well, Heather, thank you so much for sharing your valuable information. You can tell that it's something that's near and dear to your heart. And I so appreciate you tying that correlation together so that people can understand why perhaps maybe even the sexual trauma they experienced as a kid played mm-hmm. itself out in the need to control and be perfect with their food, and then they reenacted that trauma with sex, or,
yeah.
again, that symptom substitution of, okay, I don't like how I look. I've changed it. I do like how I look. And now I'm going to go out and get as much validation, encouragement, approval, and gratification as I possibly can through the use
right.
of sex. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. And talk to you soon, and let us know when you write that first book, because I know you wrote something that had to do with accounting, correct?
I'm working on it. I sure am.
And what are you writing?
I am working on a book to get for our mental health professionals. That's something that I do in addition to my private practice. I do accounting for mental health private practitioners. So okay. working on a little something. You know, half self-help book, half accounting book to kind of, you know, people really don't like accounting. So finding a way to tie those two together so it's not as scary.
Got it. All right. Well, really appreciate what you're putting your life's passion into, and wish you the best of success.
Okay. Thank you so much, Carol.
Uh-huh. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. As you can see, this is a woman who does her very best to make it her mission to help people in the arena of eating disorders and sexual addiction. We were lucky to have her on tonight. And, again, this show is specifically for you. You can always call in and ask questions, or you can email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. I'm more than happy to answer your emails both individually or on the air. And I know that I've got a couple of people that I've set up to talk with me within the next month about specific issues that have to do with their own sexual addictions. That will be interesting, too. So we will look forward to talking with you next week. As I say, at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. I want you to fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week for another episode of Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Have a great week.